place.
Attention, attention. You are listening to a pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. Curious Realm is busy traveling the vast void of time and space to find the best paradigm-changing content the universe has to offer. Enjoy the following transmission, and remember, stay curious. Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Curious Realm. So glad to have you here. So sorry that we are here in this is the time of year where we have numerous shows that we go out, that we travel to, and that I also have numerous clients that I am out traveling for. So right now I'm out working the amazing Keller Williams show in San Antonio with an awesome crew. Love working with those guys, with Shepherd. All kinds of fun stuff. But our guest tonight in the second part, we are very happy to welcome back our good friend and guest, Dennis Stone, talking about America's Stonehenge, an enigmatic spot in New Hampshire that archaeologists have yet to figure out, paleontologists have yet to figure out, even local natives. The Native American people from the area do not know where it came from. It was there when they got there. So we'll be talking with Dennis Stone about some of the latest discoveries, some of the archaeoastronomic alignments at America's Stonehenge and more. In our first segment, I am proud to welcome Cygames winner. Here's a little bit of the B-roll from Cygames, folks. This is the Psychokinesis competition. Our guest, Ryan Debian, competed in this as well as dowsing. And there were so many competitions. Ryan, welcome to the show for the first time. How are you today?
I'm doing amazing. How are you, man? It's crazy because we just saw each other at the Psy Games. And, you know, honestly, man, I know it's only been like literally, I think, just over a week since Psy Games ended. Man, it feels like it's been a month with all the stuff that's been happening between now and then. And man, I just want to say, first off, your kid's amazing.
Thank you. Same.
I so loved hanging out with him, and he did amazing on stage. It was such a proud papa moment for both of us, I think. And dude, it was so good. Psy Games 2026 was so good.
It was an amazing experience. And truly, I say it regularly on the show, Ryan, I belong to a lot of research communities. Everything, like I'm speaking at MUFON at the end of the month. I belong to paranormal research communities. I belong to cryptid research communities. As opposed to all of those where there is some sort of inlaid drama, where there is some sort of fighting in the background about trying to get a data drop on somebody or trying to get ahead of somebody else's research or trying to release before anybody else. That is not what the Psy community is about, like whatsoever. Even whenever it comes to competition in apps, like the creators of Social RV talk with the creators of the ARV app, you know, like they share data. It's one of the most amazing and beautiful communities. And truly, like you were saying, the Psy Games community specifically, this year it was 900 people came through the doors. And that's almost double what it was last year, which even as somebody who works in events, that's pretty fantastic to see. Almost a double growth in 1 year. But in addition to that, to see the camaraderie, the community that was built, the people that were talking with each other outside in the vendor areas, things like that, while presentations and even games were going on, it was really awesome. So I want to thank you for coming and competing for your second year. And for the second year, for the second year, you walked away with first prize in psychokinesis. So let's kind of dive in real quick, because we've had David Tran on the show. He was one of the perceptualists this year. He was competing against you in psychokinesis. And it's interesting because there was a person competing this year who won second place, who came last year as a total debunker.
Yeah.
he came and was not a believer. His lady competed and he was like, oh, this is a bunch of BS. And his mind was changed. And in 1 year, learned enough to be able to qualify and compete and win second place, you know? So
yeah,
it's wild. There are people in the games who, like you and David, are kind of naturals. You don't really practice. You haven't gone through any specific training in that kind of way.
I don't know about the not practice. I'm just going to throw that up. I practice all the time, but
that's
no,
true.
No specific trainings with any sort of professional, yeah. Just homegrown.
Yeah, yeah. And that's true. You do practice. I mean, honestly, you're some of my favorite online videos regarding MindSight are you. Like jumping ramps on motorcycles and stuff like that blindfolded. Dude. Like, it's pretty incredible, man. So
thank you for mentioning that. Most people don't remember that, but yes, thank you for mentioning that. Dude, that was like the scariest thing I've done with all this stuff so far. And it wasn't just like a jump, it was like a full-on like metal FMX ramp.
Yeah.
To where into a flat lip, essentially, with a half pipe that we use for our bicycle. So if you come up short, You're in a bad spot.
Yeah, yeah,
so, yeah. And then with the mindfold and the helmet bag, and yeah, dude, it's crazy, right? Like, you know, it's so crazy for me just because I, you know, a lot of people know my backstory. I've had a near death experience. I've been basically a career social worker. Seen a lot of death. It's just, you know, I've had kind of this weird eclectic background. That kind of gave me just the right kind of psychic soup, I guess would be the way to put it, to kind of make me have a little bit of a more natural ability to kind of connect with this stuff. Dude, I don't know if you saw my shirt. Dude, I love all the cryptids and the like ghosts, yes, and the like aliens. we're doing our sky watching events now that we have a sponsor for as well.
Awesome.
1000 Blindfolds is actually sponsoring our sky watching events where me and Justin from Lights Over Loveland have had crazy sightings. I think they definitely like to hang out at our parties, is what I'll say. But yeah, man, it's been a whole crazy thing, you know. And then I find out about the Psy Games last year in April. I kind of do this like coming out video to all my clinical people, all my race people, because I raced, you know, through last year when I retired. Everybody kind of thought I was crazy and kind of losing my mind. They already knew I was a little bit crazy doing all the motorcycles and stuff, but. You know, now I think that kind of sealed the deal for a lot of people, but, you know, we start training, we post all the trainings, you know what I mean? We were kind of showing our process and showing people not only how to do it, you know, in kind of a free manner, but also kind of showing, you know, my process as I was building going into the Psy Games. Psy Games last year was life-changing. I qualified for all the games in terms of the testing. But just based on the amount of people and what they were trying to accomplish with the Psy Games as well, I only did three. I podiumed in all three of the ones I did last year. So I got first in psychokinesis, second in MindSight, and second in precognition to David Tran. You know, it's just been this building, right? We've continued to train. We didn't stop training. I wasn't done at one. I wanted to come back at least this year and defend my title and show that like it wasn't just a one-off fluke. Like I train, what I say is what I say, and what I do is what I do, and I'm no joke, right? Like there's no magic here. I know Chris Ramsey's kind of thrown some shade at MindSight, but it's hard to dispute precog. It's hard to dispute, you know, psychokinesis when it's in these really controlled environments. And I want to be that guy that shows everybody like time, energy, and effort. That's like what it takes to really get into being able to do this consistently, do it on command, being able to show people, you know, that we all can do it with time, energy, and effort. It's, you know, it's for me, it's connected to this orb phenomena that has just always kind of been a part of my life, along with kind of the spiritual aspect to it. you know, and it just, it's all been flowing together over the last year. You know, we posted all of our events. I ended up being asked to go to be one of the trainers at one of the intuitive perceptions for the Psy Games. Cool. Me and David Tran killed it in every aspect. Like we set the record at 300 yards for MindSight. And I don't care who you are. We have videos of it. They were having to walkie talkie and phone call each other because they couldn't even hear each other. But, you know, besides, you know, visualize the small cards we were using. I was saying that they're about the size of the Amazon Zenners. This is my new retail section over here, but Amazon Zenners are this is them in their package, right? So at 300 yards, you can't even see that it's red, right?
Yeah.
And I'm only about maybe 10 feet from the camera. I guess my point is at 300 yards, it's hard to dispute that there's, you know, if you want to say it's MindSight, if you want to say it's precognition, but there's some sort of extrasensory perception that's going on with me and David that's next level.
Well,
right?
At 300 yards, just as a trained cameraman, just so you know, folks, just shy of end zone to end zone of an NFL stadium. So consider that to begin with.
Right?
Seeing the color of something like this at 100 yards to begin with, unaided, no telescope, no binoculars, no let me zoom in on my camera. Much less blindfolded at 100 yards. And this is like about the size of two. It's about the size of two packs of cigarettes for those asking, maybe about two playing cards stacked next to each other. So not incredibly large. Okay. So whenever you're talking about that at 300 yards to begin with, I don't care if you have no blindfold on, Ryan. I'd give somebody 10 bucks if they could tell me the color of that card dependably at 300 yards.
Right.
Period.
And that's just
period.
It, man. We had this amazing training. I met these amazing people. The venue where we did the training was next level. You know, with Michelle Fried and Kemla and Hakeem and just all the other people, it was just truly this crazy experience. Right. And, you know, I'm a goal guy. I'm a moto guy, right? Like, I like goals. So my goal of going there was knowing that they were going to have the property to set some sort of a distance record with David. You know, just keep pushing that bar higher and keep trying to make it harder for haters to have, you know, ammunition, right? And so we do that. I go to contact in the desert. You know, it's funny. I was talking with my son, Axel, and my wife and my trainer. And I'm like, guys, like, what can we do? Because Hakeem had let me know that, you know, he had asked me to be a contact in the desert. He's like, well, what do you want to do for your thing? Or, you know, we don't know if we're going to be doing it as kind of a group or if we're just going to let everybody kind of do their own thing. And I think with Sean and Dahlia kind of doing their own thing, Pat kind of had her own specialty. So we all just kind of took our turns doing our MindSight demos at Contact in the Desert, man. I wanted to get, you know, pattern recognition, reading, colors, task completion, and navigation, right? Those were the things that were really important to me. And so I did this crazy runaround in less than 5 minutes where I don't know if your kid's familiar with like Dude Perfect. It's like this channel where they do sick and ball sports and they'll combine them into these new games. And I kind of did the same where I ran around doing different challenges, trying to do it in under 5 minutes, which I did just to show everybody, you know, once again, there's cameras on you. I literally went into people's faces to be like, can you please check this midway? Just keep me legit. If you think I'm cheating, just call me out on it, you know, and did it up. And it was amazing. And I met all these amazing people there and kind of, you know, started off talking. I mean, you know, the intuitive perception and Contact in the Desert is where I was first introduced to flow state with Hakeem and the Psy Games online. I mean, there was times at the intensive where, like, you know, we would end around 9. Really, I think the whole thing was supposed to end around 6, but everybody was just still so charged up and wanted to do stuff. We'd end around 9. And then, you know, nobody was, you know, we were still all charged up even when we went home. So Hakeem would bust out from like 9 to 11. He bust out the flow state machine. And you have all these, you know, high-end practitioners is what I'll say. Doing this stuff. And it's like, man, it just felt like being in X-Men school. It was just such an amazing experience. And, you know, Hakeem's shown a lot of it. But there's, you know, there's multiple games to that thing, too, where you're – using your consciousness to drive stuff, you know? And
yeah,
it's been mind blowing, man. And then, you know, we do contact in the desert. It's amazing. We come back, we're doing our stargazing events. Those are blowing up. You know, this whole time we're trying to teach people. I have these, both weekly and bi-weekly meets that I've been doing with people, just trying, I've been not charging anything. Just trying to get people involved and get people psyched about it, get people, and, you know, one thing that's been really important to me with all the social media stuff and doing the kind of more crazier stuff that's hard to dispute is I just wanted people to be inspired. You know, when I see a person do something amazing on a dirt bike, there's this part of my soul that's like, oh my gosh, I want to ride, right? when I watch people have their mind side open, you know, for the first time or the first time they get like three sets of three of the Zenner cards where you're like, that's pretty amazing. That's like basically 10 in a row. You're sitting at nine right now. We do them in sets of three, but it's amazing. They're just the look on their face, man. And then it's like they feel it in their heart. And when they feel it in their heart, that's the moment where like you can really open up those psi abilities, that just moment of joy and happiness in your heart, man, is where it all comes from. And the Psy Games is such an amazing producer of those emotions. And it just charges everything. Dude, I'm pretty sure the electronics, you know, me and David both affect electronics. I'm pretty sure it's like a common thing just because we give off such, you know,
he broke my recorder.
Yeah, dude.
It's working now, but it completely froze up and did absolutely nothing while we were trying to record at Psy Games.
Dude,
there's five shows in that thing. So it's not like it's like beat up and running around all the time. And I've got my own experiences. I have my own things. Like I normally show them on air, but my bent silverware, I literally just had wrist surgery on both hands and both elbows. So when I did this, even now I couldn't like manually bend a spoon. If I tried to, it would be way too painful for me to do, Ryan. But to see my son do it, to see my son literally in 1 week, the week before Psy Games, he was doing his online training and he has a little sheet that he does with his stuff. How many, what game, how many misses, how many hits, what other data.
That's how you do it.
Well, and things like physiological data. Did you get a rapid heartbeat? You know, did you start sweating? Like, you know, that kind of stuff. I want him to learn that while you're applying this, you should be getting scientific data too. You know, you should be gathering that data because you have an opportunity to. And to see him hit 10 out of 10 on incoming, which is a precognitive game.
Yeah,
Where he got 10 out of 10 right, and he was psyched, man, to see him go from that the week before to walking on stage blindfolded at Psy Games for the panel, and then to see him afterward at my cousin's house in Lafayette, where I was just like, hey, give me a deck of playing cards, and he started calling the color. Okay, that's 50-50. And then he started calling the card, and it was like, oh, dang, homie can read. I was giving him Tide boxes. I was giving, like, he's never read the back of a can of wet cat food. He 100%. Read it word for word. And it was like, what is this? This is crazy. But he can do it. And it's fascinating because he had a party this weekend, man. And I was like, show your friends. And we started doing it. They were surprised. But then they were more surprised when we started taking Coke tabs. And I was like, take it right off the can, guys. Take it off the can and stick it to the wall.
Yeah.
We have Coke tabs that have been sticking to a door at the laundry room in our house for 3 days, man. And that door has been opened and closed at least 10 times to a dozen times. They're still on there, you know?
Dude, it's so amazing. My wife had never stuck a fork to anything, right? Yeah. So we were at one of the content creator houses on Friday. And she's got a penny to stick. She got a fork to stick. Dude, my son, dude, I don't know about you, but those Bombay big gold forks that they gave the people to bend at Psy Games, those are no joke forks.
They were beefy. Like,
those are big forks. So when Axel brought his up to me, he's like, Dad, look at what I bent. He was so proud. I'm like, dude, that's the thickest fork I've ever seen. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there it is with the fork yeah. sticking to the wall right there.
My wife was losing her mind in that moment. And everybody was losing their mind for her. And dude, it was that moment of fun, right? All the people were trying. And it was just like, it's just one of those moments where like, dude, yes, she got the stick, but the house's energy just skyrocketed when she got it. Dude,
oh, yeah.
A few other people got it. We were all losing our minds. And it's that energy that the side games brings, you know what I mean? And it's something, you know, for me in Moto, dude, it's amazing when you send a new jump, when you win a race, but when you do it with your friends, when your family are there, it's something completely different. Cause it's like, you know, it unlocks something new within a whole lot of, you know, different people that are seeing it, you know, the 100th monkey or whatever it is too, you know, as much as it's amazing for me and my family, and you know, I'm sure, you know, everybody that I know is a proud papa, and you too, man, we're seeing our kids doing it. We're the people in the crowd are seeing our kids do it. Right.
Yeah.
It's opening up all these levels, dude. My Moto community is pretty Christian and pretty conservative. And that's just kind of how Moto primarily is. That's not everybody, but yeah. That's a lot of it. Right. And, you know, you have this Moto dude from Colorado who's pretty much love and unconditional positive regard, but not really religious, kind of showing people that, you know, you can do this stuff and it's not woo-woo. We're not doing seances. You know, it's really like training a muscle. I know I watched David's where he was talking about it being an extra sense. It is your sixth sense. It's extrasensory perception, right? It's ESP. It's we're not, you know, maybe we are kind of tapping into this bigger collective, but it's not in any sort of a negative way. It's something that we all can do. And it's something that with training, you know, you can do it. I literally have shown it from the start, you know, and now have a back-to-back record of showing, you know, the time, energy, and effort can work to get these, you know, get the results you're looking for, no matter what it is, you know, if it's something personal in your life, or you're setting aside that time to learn a new trait like Sai, or man, setting aside the time to make sure you're having the relationship with your family and your kids. And, you know, I don't ever sleep. I live off coffee. This is the first time I don't have a Dutch Brothers with me, but you know, dude, I live off coffee just cause you know, we get one shot to dance, dude. We get one shot to live this life.
Yep.
And man, I do know what it's like to be on the other side. And I've had, you know, just so much death in the last 5 years. It's like, I want to relish every moment, take advantage of every opportunity and just show people and inspire people. Cause you know, when I leave, I know that there's going to be people that love me, man, but the more that I can spread my love, the more that people are going to love each other. And it's just going to have the ripple effect to, you know, the butterfly effect of that. And that love legacy and just wanting to help people, man, that's the goal. And so that's why we've done everything up to this point free. I think that has to change a little bit just because our events are getting way bigger. So it requires, you know, instead of us all just fronting $100, now it's going to be like 1500. That's like a whole big thing, but
it changes things. That I think that's one thing that a lot of people maybe don't understand when it comes to growing anything, Ryan, growing even any kind of movement, is at some point organization and money has to be involved. There's one of two things. I used to speak at podcast conferences whenever I had my podcast consultancy and my podcast network, and I would typically come in and have everybody get up, stretch, say hi to your neighbor, things like that. Now show me your jazz hands, everybody.
Right.
And every time I say time or money today, you show me those jazz hands. All right. because that's what it is. It's time or money. And if you want to grow something, you need one of two things. You either need time or you need money. If you have time and no money, buddy, you can learn to code WordPress. And people will forgive you. You can hack your way through the jungle and grassroots everything. And that's okay. But eventually it'll come to money. You know, if it's the only way that you grow past the grassroots of it is money. And if not, then you need money from the jump if you don't have time to grow it and grassroots it. You know, so one of the two is going to happen. And it takes one of the two to make a movement happen and to get these kind of things off the ground and to even begin spreading this message on a mass level. Ryan, because it's hugely important, I think, for us, all of us who are a part of these communities. I think that there are lives, especially myself as a host, I try to explain to other hosts, we have an onus placed upon us to clarify things. We can hypothesize, we can do all kinds of things, but what we can't do, and what I try to explain to people that my show's job is, there are tons of people around the watering hole digging rabbit holes. And they're fun to go down. They're enjoyable. But the problem is there's a bunch of dirt kicked up and it all lands in the water. And we all have to drink from that water. And at some point, somebody has to start filtering it so we can all have a good drink, you know. Right. And when it comes to these things, like you're saying, there are a lot of people that misunderstand. Last year, and any show that I go to, any show that I go and cover, I always pay for a boosted ad to help sell tickets. It's just part of what I do. Well, I paid for a boosted ad. I did not lock down the comments, Ryan. And probably about a month before the show last year, I saw an alert from my brother. It was like, oh, you know, Randy Jordan has commented on your post. And I was like, oh, which post did he comment on? And it was my Cygames ad. And his only comment was, the comments thread here is gold. And I was like, oh, crap, man. What the heck have people been saying about
Ryan?
My God, it got deep and thick quick. Everything from this is the work of Satan to you know, one person was, of course, quoting John's revelation. And I was like, as a former seminarian, I find it very interesting that you're using John the Revelator to make your point. Pretty sure he may have remote viewed the end of time.
So, dude, it's
fascinating.
It's been hard, man. It's been hard because I feel you on every moment of that, dude. I caught it in person, in a way that I probably won't describe. I caught it in person live.
Yeah.
But dude, the hater comments and just the like you were saying, man, the total misunderstanding. You know, and even from the scientific community, you know what I mean? Like, to some degree, it's like, you know, we were talking, you know, so I made these MindSide masks. They're completely sealed in. You're locked in, you're painted in. I call them the Iron Man mask, or the nightmare mask. But dude, it's trying for me to put down the haters, right? To give them less ammunition. And also to kind of take off that woo woo, you know, like, don't get me wrong. I believe in spirituality and I believe,
absolutely,
I believe that we can connect with spirits. I believe that we can connect with extra dimensional entities. I believe that orbs have probably a consciousness to them. You know what I mean? And I think there's spirit orbs that are more connected with Earth and our surroundings and our life here. And I think there's like, you know, the orbs that come from outer space are more, you know, I'll just say the space versions.
Yeah, yeah.
Earth versions and space versions, you know, because I don't know. I don't have the answers and I don't claim to, but I have a lot of experiences that I like to share with people to help get to those answers, right? And I think for me, that's what's been really important. You know, I've talked about it. I post about it. I'm going to, once again, I gave you all the cool details, but I won't give them out on this, but you know, once again, what's been really important to me is to be the trophies and receipts psychic, man. If I say I can do it, I can do it and I'll show it. If I don't say I don't have it, I don't have it. You know, it's just not there yet. And so I actually went and did 3 days of testing post Cygames in North Carolina with some different folks from around the world. I won't say exactly who was in the group, but it was a pretty elite group of folks that can produce on command is what I'll say. And man, I got amazing results. I asked for my results. I'm once again, I want to know how I was doing. I don't think everybody got the results, but I know a handful of us did. I did amazing. I won't give away the details of the data, but I did amazing. I did not get 100%, but I got gosh darn close is what I'll say.
Hey, as long as you're shooting above 60-70%, you are well above the average of guessing. And you are well above the median of just probability of landing on the answer.
You got it, man.
You know?
And what I'll say is, you know, probably one person that you would expect to do really well, just kind of based on their situation, did amazing. They're the only one that aced it. And then there's a couple of the rest of us that did amazing. And then not everybody shared the results, which is completely fine and, sure. and completely reasonable. But, you know, it that was just as impactful for me as the side games, because it was like, yeah. you know, I kind of described to you some of the things that we were doing and what was being asked of us. And it's, you know, and one thing I've heard kind of from a lot of folks that did reviews about the side games, you know, I'm watching all the side game stuff. I want to see what's happening. There wasn't the wow moment like we got with Dahlia last year. Basically, that's what everybody was saying, is there was a lot of amazing moments, but there wasn't the moment that stood out like Dahlia and her Mindsight demo going off the stage, off into the crowd, doing two at a time. You know what I mean? That was a moment. And then her with Lidu doing the telepathy, those were both moments I think really captivated everybody. And I think just kind of on the functional side, just with the way that things were moving in terms of timing, there wasn't the time for those moments, I guess, is the problem, is what I was hearing. And so, plus I think everybody wanted to be wowed. And, you know, what I'm learning from these scientists and from what I'm hearing from the crowd, and you know me, dude, I'm the dude that wants to keep pushing the limits. Everybody wants to see the person that can get the 90%. I'm not going to say I'm ever going to be 100%. Dude, professional basketball players that shoot 1,000 baskets a day and miss free throws. So, absolutely. You know, that being said, but I want to be.
You show me Shaquille O'Neal's free throw average.
Dude, exactly. You know, I want to be the dude rolling into next year that can get like, you know, 85, 90% on precognition, where maybe it's behind a wall or a board. So it's still in the vicinity where everybody in a room could see it, but yeah. it's not at all visible to me. Maybe I'll be wearing a mask and there'll be a wall, or, you know, I'd already been working on that with like weird technologies, because I had had this MMA guy who I found out too, actually didn't just call me out. He called out David Tran as well. I didn't know that till this, you know, past experience. But just also that just tells me that dude's probably just trying to ruffle feathers compared to trying to prove a point. But
well,
I can prove it more through the scientists than I can through that guy. You know what I mean? So,
and you know, that's, honestly, what it comes down to, Ryan, is the fact of you have to prove nothing to nobody to begin with. There's no reason for you to have to please any. And just so you know, folks, skeptic right here, fully skeptical about everything in the world. Even my own experiences have no problem being skeptical about it. Like I said, I've got like 4 or 5 aluminum pull tabs hanging on my door outside right now that I put there. Would love to be able to explain it. It's on a hollow particle board door that definitely ain't magnetic or has nothing magnetic inside of it. And it's aluminum, so it's not magnetic. So I'd love to be able to scientifically explain that. Can't. Just strange. Weird. Quarters do it. All kinds of things. The thing is, as a skeptic, you're supposed to be looking for the data that changes your mind. You aren't supposed to be looking to debunk everything. There's a difference there. And when it comes to science, especially, you know, they if you say you have evidence, they are going to eviscerate you. That's their job, is to poke holes with rapiers into things called evidence and see if they still float, Ryan. However, if you come to them and say, I've got some really weird anomalies here, I'd love to have them examined. That's a different story. And they come at it from very much the same aspect that these scientists did examining you and David and other people. You know, the idea of how do we quantify this? And like you said, the fact of their want, the expectation is for that 100%, you know, But you've got to give the anomaly the room and the credence that it deserves when you're still banging out a 75 to 85 percentile. And that is well over average, and that is well beyond just random chance to be averaging that, you know?
Dude, I won't give too much more because I want to be real careful, because I know already everybody knows. But what I'll say is, we use progressive masks that went all the way from our mind folds through, you know, what was, you know, once again, my mask is pretty extended. It covers your whole face. What I will say is we ended up in a helmet. That was much bigger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was amazing. And that, you know, just on my heart, man, just to know that I got to be a part of that, be part of that group. I had an amazing time. I want to say more because there was just so much more to it, but I'm just going to probably end that portion of it there. But
it's where you have to end it. There are NDAs involved, there's science involved, all kinds of
things. Everyone that was there that last night with the camaraderie is what I'll say. And ending on the music is what I'll say, man, that I will never get to not live that moment. I'm so happy that I get to remember that in my heart. Cause man, that was powerful.
Well, and let's start getting into that real quick. Let's start getting into the feelings that come from it, where this sources from for you, Ryan. Because the only way I can grasp it, I guess I have been somewhat emotive in life, you know, where I've been able to empath what people feel, things like that. But aside from that, I do some remote viewing. I am no precognitive. I guess I can precog tech issues. Like I can call that pretty rapidly. Like this will, given this situation, this will happen. Like I guess you can call me a prophet in that way because I always give an option out.
Pattern recognition, man. Pattern recognition.
If we do this, this likely will not happen. But in the same right, some of that, yes, does come from ethereal places. Like I see it and I see the situation happen. And I normally take a circumventing path, you know, like, oh, no, I see this is going to happen. I'm going to bring this spare piece of gear just in case. But that all sources very naturally. None of it comes from any kind of training except remote viewing. And even then, only in the last year has it become the fact of synesthesia has set in some ways, like with the ideogram. For instance, you know, just so you know, folks, in protocol controlled remote viewing, you use what's called an ideogram, and it's basically just a subconscious squiggle on the paper. Go wherever your hand's moving. And then from there, you touch and synesthete things from the ideogram. You touch the ideogram, you feel it, you move your hand over it. And yeah, impressions start happening, things start occurring for you, because that was the one competition that you did not compete in was remote viewing. Yeah. Out of
sort of life.
And there was dowsing, there was psychokinesis, there was mindsight and precognition, the other being remote viewing. So five disciplines and a couple competitions, a big one, then a remainder competition for each one. But I'm very interested to hear how this works for you, how data comes into you, because for me, it comes through very emotionally, through empathic means. And then aside from that, like I said, I lean on remote viewing and the idea of synesthesia. So how does this information come in for you for these different disciplines?
You're saying all the right things, man. So you're on the right track for sure. You know, and I just want to start off by saying this section of it, I think everybody gets there a different way, man. Yeah. Everybody experiences it a little bit different. Like, I know I'm probably the only dude that trains MindSight in the dark. Like, we train with the lasers and I have them going on now. So if you see weird things strobing in the background, like, you know, we train with all this distraction. But I think that kind of helps in the end. But I know, like, you know, Dahlia and their crew might train completely different than Rob Friedman and his crew. And just, you know, the average Joe who's trying to pick it up off videos, you know, we all train a little bit different. So I think everybody can kind of get there in their own way. But, you know, for me, they're all related, dude. And it really comes from that emotional place. You know, when I describe it to people is that moment when you're so angry and you can just feel it in your heart, you get that moment, right? And or that moment where we saw our kids on the stage doing the mindsight and they're saying all these nice things. And we have that moment in our heart where it's just so much happiness. And it's like, it becomes almost to the point of like overwhelming and whatever that emotion is, right? If you can learn to kind of harness that emotion and not lose it, but be able to kind of channel it, man, that's psychokinesis 101. I'm telling you, that's anybody that watched me during the side games this year or last year, but specifically this year, you know, if they had the camera on me, I was crying. My son was cheering for me. I wasn't moving my hands dramatically, but it kept flowing through because for me, that emotion is what really helps the overdrive kick in for all these emotions or for all these psi abilities, right? And so psychokinesis 100% for me is emotional, all emotion. Dude, being able to affect random number generators like the Weirdoscope or the social RV game that they made for psychokinesis, being able to affect lottery machines. I have a pretty amazing history of gambling in Vegas. But being able to affect things with your energy, man, is that's all emotion. And even the bikes, you know, I use these bigger analogies so people understand how you could use it practicality, right? Like, precog, man, we, you know, in the games we were doing the lottery, which once again, I'm pretty good at. I did not do as well this year as I thought I was going to do. I tried to psychokinesis those darn ping pong balls out of that machine, but it didn't work. But you know, we train with like, you know, people ask how it comes. It comes with these emotions. It comes with just knowing, right? And when you're in some of these masks that these scientists are wanting you to get into, you know, if you're not comfortable with yourself and there is nothing else happening, stimuli going on other than what you have in your head, you know, it could take you to a lot of weird places, but it's focused intention. It's knowing that you're doing this for your family. You're doing this for yourself. You're doing this to grow. You're doing this. All these different heart-based things for me is what I tell myself when I'm trying to do these things or lead up into it. And it comes, you know what I mean? It comes a lot easier. It's not always clear and perfect and amazing, but it usually comes and produces. And I just, you know, I anybody that watches my videos, I show people how you can train precog, how you can train remote viewing. There's, you know, I think there's many different ways of remote viewing now that are kind of coming into their own. We've got all these different versions of that. And I think even, you know, MindSight kind of has, you know, it's separate categories now of like intuitive and then like real time. I think as we're getting more into this consciousness culture, things are kind of, you know, kind of making their own way and kind of finding their own path. And it's just been amazing, man. It's been a little bit scary kind of putting myself out there, straight honesty, you know, cause I do show a lot of emotion. Yeah. I show my kids emotions. I, once again, man, I wear my heart on my sleeve, good or
bad.
You have to, man. Cause I want people to know it's real. So when they see me do something amazing, they're not like it's magic or he's doing it. I show my whole process. I show the tables, I show the cards, I show everything. Well, and then I do it for people in person using the exact same stuff, you know, and you guys saw, I mean, it's, I go to these places to show it and it's not just to say it's me, man. It's just to, I'm the inspiration, man, and the movement is the point. The movement is the goal. The making it so that we can't be lied to. You know, there wouldn't be any need for conspiracy if we had telepathy. And I think kind of the overwhelming part of what people are really wanting to see is they're wanting to see the dude that can predict the future, or gal, or whoever it might be, the person that can do real telepathy. And I think you're talking about empathy. You know, I don't think telepathy is reading people's minds. I think it's just being able to read their energy, man, to the point where you're just so in tune with where they are. You're thinking the exact same thing because you're in the exact same mindset, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is, it's interesting because you brought up a couple of points that we got into and that we've gotten into in the past, specifically with remote viewing. Numerous different modalities and disciplines to the point that they are defined as different modalities and disciplines, because while they lean on protocoled CRV, controlled remote viewing, they follow different things. They don't necessarily have a blind target like CRV does, that kind of stuff.
Just to throw this in so people get the secondary reference, you know, there's motocross, right, or dirt bike riding in general, which is the big, right? But then you have supercross and arena cross, and you have all these different versions with the exact same bikes, right? And so for folks that may not know, that listen to me, but may not know all of the stuff, he's saying that it's all the same, but it's different expressions of the same modality.
Yeah, different forms, slightly different rules, even.
Yes.
You know, all that kind of stuff. So, and it's fascinating because one of the things that we got into with Chase McCarty of Social RV was the whole idea of ARV, associative remote viewing, the binary concept of a coin flip, yes or no, stock options. And even the weird anomaly of you can paper trade all day with ARV and the numbers are there. And they show, and it's great, and it's good results. The minute you put money down, it changes it. And it's weird. It's just this weird anomaly in the data set where once you put it to practical use of making money and profit from it, it's like it won't let you do it. It's weird. It's a totally weird anomaly in the data set, but it's a truism, and it's there, and it's shown in data, and it's funky because, like you said, during the precognitive part, you tried PKing the balls that you wanted up to the top,
100%.
But it wouldn't let you do it. It morally wouldn't let you do it. In that kind of way. And it's not that you can't PK. You can PK better than anybody. You won PK.
2 years, 2 years. Dude, here's my two cents on it, dude.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've had my biggest nights in Vegas when it's a group of like me and like my race team and my family. We would have these big family reunions, and it's like up to like, you know, 25 people of my family. And I would have these amazing nights, and we'd all go out to these fancy dinners, and I would pay for everything. I wasn't really paying for it. The night was creating itself, right? And, you know, when I would then go back after it, everybody's in bed, I would lose anything else I put in. Yeah. And just for folks to know, when you win, say, $80,000, if you gamble away $50,000
that same night,
you're still paying taxes on that $80,000. So people that just think it doesn't work like that, it totally does. That's real life version of gambling.
Well, at the same token, it's also the fact of you were doing it just to have fun at that moment.
Exactly.
You weren't doing it for the focused purpose of gambling.
You got it, man. And you know,
it was an entangled moment between everybody and the universe. So, you know, let's make something happen.
Exactly. I think the universe, if it's like, dude, we're going to send a little bit extra towards this person. They want to make sure they're using it in the right way. Their heart's in the right place. Right. And 100% of what you just said, man, when your heart's in the right place, I always say your heart matches your words, matches your actions. That's where I wear my heart on my sleeve. Like what you see is what you get. You know, it's an amazing thing, because when you just live authentically like that, I think the universe just wants to work for you, right? Like, it's like, you know, if we're going to send it, you know, some way, to send it to the dude that's doing it the right way. It's not deceitful. It's not for personal gain. It's, man, he's going to have his family have this night to remember if we send it this way. That's sending like 25 G's on the machine, and he's not going to know what to do with his life for the next 2 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and especially that idea of, once again, doing it to show off or doing it as a grounded purpose, you know, and something with a mission. And I think that there is something hugely to be said about that. Because,
dude, my whole life for the last year is exactly that, man. I feel like anytime I've tried to veer off, and, you know, I've been selling retail at some of the events just to try to make some of the money back, because we're just trying to break even on things. And, you know, I don't think I would be in this position if I was being deceitful. You know what I mean? I don't think I would be in this position in my life in general, you know, between the racing and my family and just, you know, the straight up blessed life I've been able to live, I think, is a lot because I live authentically and I'm for the most part dependable, probably a little bit less dependable in this last like month because I've been all over the board just trying to get all these things for side games and these events and Contact in the Desert and the Intuitive and all that like kind of came all at once. But man, I appreciate people like you too, man, because don't get me wrong. I want the skeptics. I need a reason. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I'm a competitor, right? Like I wouldn't have signed up for the side games just to show I came because I knew if it was a competition and it caught, you could change the world and what you would show. Like if I, you know, straight honesty, if I knew back then when I signed up that I could show that these things are available, I would be showing all these people the ways to train it. Dude, so many people came up to me at the games just saying how inspirational I was. And that was, yeah. Dude, that made me cry. Like so many times, my son made me cry. But then the competitor in it that was like, dude, I'm coming for you next year. And it was like on the big stage at the end on Sunday. Like that was the moment I was waiting for. Cause it's like, dude, you inspire people. You hit the right buttons. You're doing the right thing. Just keep being you. Be authentic, you know? And it's, I can't even tell you, man. It's exactly what you just said. When it comes from the place of love, hard matches, words matches, actions, I think the universe wants to give you that extra little oomph of you know, butterfly effect air to help you get you over the ledge to where you could be, you know? And don't get me wrong, it took a ton of time, energy, and effort, tons of time, absolutely, you know, thinking about how we're going to do the game, setting up. You know, I didn't have any sort of, I would do my races on YouTube, but we didn't have like the cameras or the laptops to do any of the stuff that we do now. And, you know, it's just been a ride, man. And I just am so grateful. I just to keep piggybacking on what we're saying, I'll be done with it, man. I'm so grateful to everyone. I just want to take a moment to say I'm grateful to you to have me on. I'm grateful to every podcaster that's had me on. I'm so beyond grateful to Hakeem and that executive team. I mean, I'm friends with all of them. Dude, I just want to give a shout out to David. And man, driving all those people on that thing was a little bit hard. I'm just saying. but you know, because I wasn't expecting those big old bands. I was expecting like a band anyways. But you know, like it's an amazing group and you're motivated, right? You're motivated to help that keep growing because it's just such an amazing thing. And the people that are making it are what really are putting the icing on the cake to this amazing event and this amazing movement, man. It's a movement at this point.
It is. And especially whenever you're talking about purpose, whenever you're talking about doing these things with purpose, Ryan, it is, I think that's probably after years of teaching spirituality to junior high school students, young adults, things like that. The idea of alignment, not even manifestation, because manifestation's easy. Honestly, yeah. It's pushing the slinky. Once you're aligned, the manifestation isn't hard. The hard part is getting yourself aligned with the point of manifestation. It's getting yourself aligned to the point, even whenever you're talking about training with things like this. When I'm sticking something to the wall, I have to align myself with that object and with the intent of why I'm sticking it to the wall. Not about proving it to somebody, not about proving it to myself. I have to align myself to the fact of not this might stick to the wall. Man, I hope this happens. It is truly that yodic concept of you do or you do not. There is no try. The second that you say, I'm going to try, you've already doubted. You failed, like immediately. You failed. You put up, like you allowed a brick to get in your way. You may as well build a wall.
Dude, that analogy is amazing. I'm going to start using that brick analogy. I love that. Yeah, but dude, it's, for me, it's the analogy of you don't want to come up short on the 120-foot triple, man. You just, there's a moment where you just switch it off and you're like, this is going to happen. Do or do not. If you're not making this, you're in a bad place, man. So send it, you know, full throttle, focus, all of it. And let's get over it. And that's one more, you know, thing that we now have under our belt, you know, and you know, it's weird for me to some degree, just straight honesty, man. I'm a heart on my sleeve guy. I don't think the moto in me is ever going to change. You know, you just showed that picture of me. I'm even doing it kind of X game style. You know, I don't think the competitor in me is probably going to change too much. That's just, that's super deep in my soul. But good. You know, for me, it's that reason, man. And the reason isn't to send the 120-foot jump to show off to everybody to be like, look at Ryan. The reason to send the 120-foot jump is that there's going to be a kid or my kid or your kid or an adult out there that's going to be like, dude, I can do 140. There's going to be a dude that, you know,
there's a person out there
that's going to see yourself. What I'm saying. You know what I'm saying? And that's the goal, man, because if in my lifetime we can accept that this is really part of it and stop thinking that we can't and start thinking about how we can and then start applying this and teaching it and being able to, you know, the easiest way to test telepathy. I'm not a secrets guy, man. If you want to really learn how to train telepathy with a friend, have a friend roll a dice in a separate room, be like we are on a computer, have them write that number on a dry erase board that you cannot see and have that try to send it to that person. Do that 15 times in a row. What I can tell you is our group of psychic folks that we train with, we've done that many, many times. And our group is so connected. We know when one of us is sick or off. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's the same way that like a mom knows the schedule or when something's off with a kid, just because you are so connected with that person. It's not that you're reading their mind. It's that you're just in that moment with that person, giving them that the time and focus of yourself that you're then able to be like, oh man, they seem like they're a little bit down today. Or, you know, you're having that connection, man. And when you can learn how to like, I can have a connection with that person and I'm going to refine that connection to this room and you can kind of get extra sensory in, it becomes an overload sometime, but it can help, you know, in practical application, it can help de-elevate crisis.
Yeah.
It can help, you know, have better outcomes. It's just, there's real ways of applying this stuff that are not mystical I just wish people would kind of get over this hump of woo-woo and get into the like, you know, if I am in a dark place or I'm in a bad situation where I don't have all my vision, and man, if I can be aware of my surroundings, I've just changed my likelihood of having a more successful outcome than I am, you know, running into things or being in a less safe situation. It's so much bigger than me, man, and being a part of this. And part of this movement, and dude, Dahlia's teaching blind people to see. Mic drop. You know what I mean? Like, mic drop. Yeah. Anybody that's there, and I've met Sean and Justin, and they're legit, dude. Sean can take out both of his eyes because they're prosthetics. You know what I mean? When this dude's doing his thing on stage, and especially with other things that I've seen, it's like, I want to take every hater and just have them shake his hand. And have his other hand have his eyes in it.
Yeah.
And be like, now keep saying what you're saying to all these other folks, man. Yeah. And
now say he memorized where your hand was.
Yeah, exactly. He's just keep the nonsense flowing because, dude, when you meet these people and you know their hearts, man, I am more motivated than ever to keep this going and keep it being legit, keeping the science moving. You know, X Games is my favorite thing, dude. And if you were seeing this happens, the side of my movie props and stuff, that side's all dirt bikes and bicycles. Like, I want to keep progressing. I want to help being a person that keeps setting this bar so that we can get to that person that can levitate, that we can get to that person that maybe has 100% accuracy to the point that they help change the world in some positive way. And the last thing I want to say, too, is, I love Akeem Isler and I've not given enough shout out to him, man. I think he's an intelligent dude. I think he's an amazing human being in terms of all the things he's accomplished and done. And man, one thing he strives to all of us perceptualists the most, especially, you know, us that are returning and now are kind of putting things out there. You know, it comes from this heart base, this acceptance base. It's not that it's just us. It's that everybody can do it. It puts these really good ethics in place that help guide, at least for me, you know, what I do with this. And I know he knows I mean it. I know the other perceptualists mean it. Like, we want to help, you know, we want to be the Jedi And yeah. I do think, you know, I think there is, man, if you train it and you had bad intentions to it and you could figure out how to make that bad intentions work, you know, I'm not going to lie and say that I've had moments where I've been so angry, man. It's like I'm the Hulk. And yeah. I won't say exactly what happened, but dude, I'm about 180 pounds, maybe 5'9" in tall shoes. You know what I mean? But dude, I've literally, in my moments of just craziness, I've literally lifted cars by myself, a Volkswagen Rabbit specifically. And like, I've literally tore trees from the ground. Like, just because I've had these moments, and I don't know if that's specifically me in the PK or whatever, but you know, just being able to have these moments where you're so emotional, man. If you have a person that doesn't know how to control that in the right way and have these extra, you know, I'm just saying you could be on the dark side, and the whole point is to inspire people to be doing it in the right way, the ethical way. I'm not trying to read everybody. I'm not trying to remote view in your house.
Yeah. You know. No, and you know, that's something that I bring up regularly, is the safeties, the ethics that happens with all of these. Doesn't matter if it's dousing somebody's property for water.
Yeah.
The ethics involved with all of them is just out of control, out of pocket, even to the point that with the military controlled remote viewing program, the first rule was you do not interfere. You like, it was very Star Trek in its way of like, you do not interfere. You do not influence. That's not what this is for. And it was fascinating to see that. I echo that all the time. The fact of like, there it was being used by the CIA and the military. And the first rule was you do no harm. We aren't there to stop somebody's heart remotely. We like, that's not what this is for and about, you know? And it's fascinating just to bring it full circle, Ryan. It is. I love talking with people like you who are passionate about this, who are experiencers, who are people who have had an inkling in this their whole life and have just been emboldened to come forward, to come out with this and to share their gifts with the world and to tell the whole world, like you're telling your son, like my son was taught this weekend. We can all do this. I'd love to say there's something truly special about you. Ryan,
yeah, I'm just a figurehead at the moment.
The fact is, you're just one of the many that is on the front blade of the spear that is coming out into this world to show everybody that this is an innate quality. This is something that exists in all of us. I went through zero special training, everybody. Zero. I sat with Kimla and David at an intensive here in Austin for a few days. But aside from that, like, they gave me a coin and they said, put this on the wall and believe it's going to stick. And it's stuck. Like, I don't know what else to say about it. I'd love to say that there was like, you know, an intensive hour and a half of this is how you make the coin stick. There was 0% of that. None.
Dude, it's flow. It's flow state and it having that childish kind of like, for every championship, there is, you know, every time, I just want people to know, this is why I post stuff as well. For every one of my amazing sizzle reels, there's about 45 minutes of like just plowing through and it's not amazing, right?
Yeah.
For every moto championship, there's literally been 100 fifth places, you know what I mean? Where it's almost right there, but just not enough to keep me motivated, not enough to discourage me, but
yeah.
You know, it is, man. It's all of us. And I think when we all realize that we're all capable of this, I call them shrimp moments. We all have that moment where it changes us. It touches us. It touches our hearts. It must be like, well, maybe, sticking the stuff on the walls or, you know, the Zenner card call out or having your windows open for the first time or any of these things, man, you just need that one experience and it's just going to change your life, man. It may not change it completely if you don't give it the time, energy, and effort, but man, it's just for people to know it's real. You know what I mean? And don't get me wrong, when if you sit here and you do it all day, you're gonna be a lot more accurate than if you only do it maybe once a month kind of thing. But it just to know it's real. let's acknowledge it, to acknowledge that there's these people that are around the world training. Man, we have the five categories in the side game. But dude, I met so many people that it's like, man, how could you categorize what I just saw that was so amazing that this person did? You know what I mean? Like,
and you know, really, it is the one thing that rings through my head more than anything on these weekends, Ryan. As a former Catholic seminarian, former youth minister, Matthew 18 is what comes to my head regularly. Truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. The idea that a child, and what this roots to is just the idea that children do not hate by nature. They don't hate guy, girl, guy dressed as a girl, 0% until you have taught them to hate. Until it doesn't matter the color, the creed, what somebody believes, there is 0% hate in a child's heart. That is something that we've learned. There is a purity to thought, a purity of heart with a child that exists. I'm weeping right now.
Dude, I'm literally, I'm like, dude, you're not supposed to make me cry on a podcast. And it's like, quite, you know what I mean? Quite, what you're saying is so.
But that's just it.
It's we so lose, powerful.
We 100%, lose
100%.
And when you that's how Angela Thompson Smith taught me to bend this spoon. That's how I bent my first spoon. Was being at one with a childlike point of joy. Right? And that's what she told me. She was like, remember a point as a child where you were utterly joyous about something, anything, doesn't matter. Connect with that and invite that spoon to be a part of that moment with you. That's how I was taught to bend a spoon.
My screen is blowing up because you made me cry.
but quite literally, it's one of those, we have to learn to trust. We have to learn to trust ourselves. We have to learn to trust our inner nature again. We have to learn to trust that pull to what we know is right and to what we can naturally do. Because once again, you are amazing at being 100% natural, Ryan. And you practice at being 100% natural, and it shows. And it shows through your skills. It shows through your skills on stage. It shows through your child, through your family, through the love that you give to the world around you. So I want to thank you for everything that you are doing. I want to thank you for everything that you are bringing to this community, because it truly does take a community to get this across and to change humanity in that kind of way. So thank you for being a beautiful part of it. Let everybody know where they can go to follow you, where they can come to be a part of the Star Watch parties, where they can come for training.
Absolutely, man.
Or even advice.
Straight up made me cry a little bit, because it is, man. I was just thinking, man, was so powerful. And then I won't get onto it because I'll start rambling again, but you can catch me at Monstrous on Instagram. It's Monstrous Nightmare 1234. Social media, if you just Google search my name, you'll see all the different things I've done on YouTube. If you look up Rhino Pit Monstrous Nightmare Racing, I'm on YouTube, with my own channel. It's still a lot of dirt bikes. I haven't put a ton of the side stuff, but exactly. And then Lights Over Loveland, their podcast has captured a lot of our events. We've been working a lot with Colorado Stargazing 369. You can look up any of those things and I'm sure you'll find it somewhere, man. I just want to say thank you to having me on and, man, giving me that moment there at the end. Cause it is, man, it's going to be the fact that we don't all have to agree with each other. Not every single kid likes each other just by knowing each other, you know, but nobody comes with this bias of hate, man. Unconditional positive regard, this moment of realizing that we're all human, we're all doing this for the first time, and that we're all connected. We're all the same thing, just experiencing it differently. And if we can realize what it might be like to be in somebody else's experience, it changes everything. Empathy, man. You said all the right words. I And then you ended it with me crying. This is a favorite episode. I love this.
Well, that's what it's all about, man, is real, true. And you are definitely that, my friend. So thank you so much once again for your time today. Thank you so much for all you do. We've got to have you on again and again. And we've definitely got to keep the kids connected for the future.
For sure, man.
So,
for sure.
Hold the line real quick while we close things out for this segment, Ryan. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from our good friend Ryan Debian, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of our on-site coverage from amazing events like Cygames and MUFON coming up at the end of the month. You can also find your link to Curious Research in the Field Observation Log. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend Dennis Stone, owner of America's Stonehenge. We will be talking about this mysterious location nestled in New Hampshire, its archaeoastronomic alignments, and so much more right after this, everybody.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, folks, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part. That's seeds, stems, buds, roots, fibers. Every part is used, combusted, and reused, and that process followed time and time again till nothing remains but an amazing spigeric product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out, everybody. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get free edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Dennis Stone. He is the owner of America's Stonehenge. His family has owned this property for better than 50 years now, and the work that they have done and amassed at this location is fantastic. I mean, it's one of those. Dennis, welcome back to the show, number one. Give me just a second. I just had an issue with my headphones. I have to go to my backup line. There we go. but your family has owned this property since you were a child. How did you first come to own the property, and how have the renovations, how did they begin, and where have they gone since?
Well, good evening, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on the set again. It's so wonderful to see you and talk with you again, and looking for you next visit up to New England and stopping by and maybe doing a little video up there, a little podcast.
Right.
That'd be wonderful. It's been closer to 70 years. Actually, 71
wow.
years my dad first visited the site back in 55 because of a radio show. You know, it was WBZ Boston, big station in New England, AM station. And a Friday night, just heard about it. I'd never heard about the place before and just was fascinated by the topic. And the show host was Alton Hall Blackington from the state of Maine. You might know where Maine is, I think. And, that's where he was from. And he would be on this Boston station. And it was syndicated in Maine, too, you know, in different places. He eventually saw the site a few days later with my aunt and uncle, who used to come down here back in the 30s picnicking, you know. So my mom's sister and her husband, and they had forgotten completely about their bicycle trips back in the 30s where they were dating. You know, I'm sure it just slipped their mind over the decades. But by 1955, he brought this magazine home from the barbershop, which is another big coincidence. Right after the radio show, he goes to a barbershop. He's waiting to have his hair, opens up a New Hampshire Profile magazine. It's kind of like Yankee is big magazine in New England. This is a New Hampshire Profile. But this time there's pictures, you can see what it looks like, and there's a whole feature article, totally excited him. And that was right after the radio show, and then he goes to my aunt and uncle's to play cards on a Saturday night with about 10 people, passes the magazine around, nobody knows what it is until my aunt and uncle saw it, and it's like, oh. So that Sunday they went down, checked the site out. After looking for it, it was not open to the public. There was no Google Maps. There was no road signs, and there was no visitor center, no parking lot. It was just an old road that went on top of the hill. They took a chance and parked there, basically walked up a half a mile. When they got on top, there's the site. They were just blown away by it. Basically trespassing, too, because it was all private property. My dad climbed under the chain link fence and spent quite a bit of time looking around, just fascinated by the stone structures. Never seen anything like that. When he came back out under the fence, he snuck under the fence. The fence was put up in 1937 by the first researcher archaeologist, Mr. Goodwin, from Hartford, Connecticut. It's still there today, 90 years later. But he climbed under the fence. It had barbed wire on top. It's still there today, too. He wanted to protect the site from vandalism. So that fence has served its purpose for 90 years. And he was just amazed. And he said to everybody, you know, it's just the most mind-boggling thing I've ever seen. It's all these stone ruins and huge stone slabs, chambers, you know, a courtyard, plaza, all that. And then he goes something about he'd like to open the site up to the public, maybe as an attraction or museum, because my mom said, you got rocks in your head, you know? And I think he did. That didn't deter him. He just went forward with the whole thing. And at that time, I was a baby. My sister was on her way at that moment. And they had built a new home, and they were still building it. They built it themselves with a couple of relatives. And my dad had a new AT&T Bell Labs job. And he was there for 30 years. But he just got out of the Coast Guard, and he was up in Labrador right near the Viking site. Actually, that's in Newfoundland. He was right across the bay from that Lonzo Meadow site.
Oh, wow.
And that fascinated him. But he was there too early because the discovery of that was about 1960, and he got out of there by 53. He was up there for a while working the Loran stations up there. And he was attending college, so he had a lot of stuff on his plate. My mom's like, you're crazy. We got enough stuff going on. You know, my sister was on her way. But he met the owner of the site, and over the next 3 years, till 1958, they worked on an agreement, and they opened it up as the Stone Ruins of New Hampshire in 1958 on the summer solstice. It was a stop, coincidentally, because we didn't know anything about the astronomy of the site, but it was a stopped opening. And a couple weeks later, on the I think it was July 11th or 12th. I'm always mixing. I should look at my book. It was the official opening, and the governor showed up. And the governor's name always escapes me because he had a very, I think, a strange last name. But he showed up, which is wonderful. He's only the second governor, I think, to ever visit our site.
Oh, wow.
That we know of, that we're aware of. And he was there for the opening. So we've been open coming up, let's see, we're in 2026. So in 2028, we'll have our 70th year open to the public.
Wow.
Where's the time go? I can still remember that.
Is fascinating, man. Just 70 years to be open. And true Americana. That's true American history right there. That is from the beginning of family road trips. This place has been around. That is wild to think about, Dennis. And quite honestly, I think your dad and my dad should get together and go bowling, because that honestly sounds like something my dad would do. Like, hear about some, oh man, this, I heard about this place on a radio show like three blocks away from my house. Never even knew it was there.
Yeah, sure.
I wonder if I could buy that and open it up. you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You open it up. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, I guess. My dad actually was in a bowling league, and he played baseball at AT&T Bell Labs. He had a huge campus there. Today, it's where Amazon and Andover sit, you know, part of it. But it was a huge campus with between 10 and 20,000 people, depending of the era. And Bell Laboratories was there. My dad got the fortune to work in Bell Labs, which is pretty kind of prestigious. He wasn't always in Bell Labs, but he did work in there. And when he was here, he didn't want to get out of that lab. It was so interesting, you know. But so then he would just move over, you know, down the hall a few hundred feet to the, his wherever the office was he was working at. But yeah, he was there 30 years. And so he ran the business on the side, and my mom helped out, and we were just little kids, of course. My dad passed away in 09, you know, so it kind of fell into my lap and my wife, you know. My sister actually kind of was involved with it a little bit over the years. She was a nurse, and she loved making pottery. We sold some of her pottery at our museum, I think. But she passed away in 2012 from cancer. Just going on 56, you know, and it was right after my dad passed, you know, so it's just me. I'm the only one left. And my mom passed away in 19 at almost 100 years old, 16 days short of her 100th birthday.
And, yeah, so, you know, thinking about that, Dennis, because that is, it's amazing to think that he got to see that much of the longevity of the site, that he got to see that much of the dig process and progress over the years, that he's gotten to see. I mean, he got to see everything up to the drone photos that we have that we're going to be showing in a second. He got to see astro-archaeological alignments. He got, like, even once again, to think about my dad running across something like this, just driving down the road and going, "Ah, man, that's a beautiful piece of property. I want to do something with that." You know, and then finding all this, what an amazing piece of happenstance to begin with. Once again, to have heard about something on a show, become enthused and enthralled by it, purchase the property, and then come to find out that, A, it's a massive swath of property. Let's start getting into these pictures, because this is a big piece of property that this encompasses. And when you start looking, like, once again, here's just this regular guy who sees a piece of property, some interesting structures on it, and goes, you know, maybe we should open that up as like a roadside attraction. Little does he know that there's like major astro-archaeological alignments on this property.
Yeah, they didn't know. They didn't know when they first got there. It wasn't until 65 they actually got involved with the astronomy.
Wow.
But before that, in 1959, the Saturday Evening posted a feature article on our second year we were open, which is wonderful, you know, to have a major magazine.
Yeah.
And it's still around today, I think. I Googled that. It's still around. But it was so major. And it was wonderful. Everybody looked forward to it. They had those real, I think at the artist, they always had those beautiful covers. But we have that actual magazine. Like, we still have the New Hampshire Profile magazine, too, from 53. So 6 years later, a different author came along and wrote us up in 59. And the gentleman referred to the site as a Stonehenge of America. You know, it was America's Stonehenge. And it's like, wow. So it's kind of a little bit of a nickname, not used very much in the 60s until the astronomy work. And then people recall this America's Stonehenge. But primarily because 65 was in Gerald Hopkins. He was from England originally, worked at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And I believe he was either at BU or BC. I think it could have been BU. I always get those two universities in Boston mixed up. And he was a professor of archaeoastronomy. And he wrote about Stonehenge and said Stonehenge is a computer. So the book was called Stonehenge Decoded. And that same year in 65, when the book came out, he had wrote a paper in 63, I guess the same, you know, a paper on this too. And then he made it into a book. And we sold the book in our gift shop for years. But CBS did a special called The Mysteries of Stonehenge. I saw it once in 65 when it came out. And in the 70s, my cousin and some of the staff members at America Stonehenge, we decided to go over to the Nashua, New Hampshire Library, I believe it was, over 50 years ago. And for some reason, we knew we could watch it over there, you know, and we did. I mean, it's different now. You can probably pull it up on YouTube, I guess. But that really got my dad, all the researchers interested in what are those stones that are standing up surrounding the main site out in the woods. They look like big arrowheads standing up. Some of them are laying on their side, but obviously they were standing up. What was their purpose, if there was any purpose? And so they started thinking about maybe they're aligned with the, something like the sun or moon, perhaps. Like there's the summer, winter solstice sunset. You can see it's kind of arrowhead shaped. And you have to have two markers to have an alignment. You have to have two fixed markers made out of stone, wood, or whatever, your concrete, whatever you want. You can't have just one point. Otherwise, you can make every day of the year by just walking around it, you know? And there is an astronomical center. And one of the earlier photographs you showed everything coming to a center. And today we have about 57 alignments with the sun, moon, and stars that we're aware. That's right there. You can see where everything comes together. And they come together where there used to be two piles of rocks we call cairns. And Mr. Goodwin photographed them. He diagrammed them in the 1930s. He could not figure out what the devil their purpose was. They seemed to be significant, and yet he couldn't determine anything about them. He thought they were hollow beehive chambers like what the Irish monks used in Ireland. He thought they were connected to the oracle chamber, and they were not. So what he did eventually, when he decided they were solid stone piles side by side, is to use some of that rock to rebuild the ramp near the sacrificial table. We have pictures of a three-legged tripod, I guess three, I'm redundant, but a tripod made out of wood with a winch on top with a handle, with a cable. And they were lifting up the rocks from those piles in the late 30s, rebuilding the ramp, which is, you can see the sacrificial table. Out of the frame to the right is where he was putting the stones, and they're there today. He basically destroyed what we call the astronomical center today. But what he did discover, Chris, is below the two of these cairns, and they were side by side, he found out where that table originally was quarried from by the original builders. There's actually a bell shape, like the shape of the table, a bell shape in the bedrock, and it is a big piece of something missing there, and that is where the table originated from. They were able to quarry it out of the bedrock, and they moved it about 40 feet, set it up on its four legs, and it weighs about 9,000 pounds. So the bad and the good were, the bad was they destroyed our astronomical center, and 40 years later, we determined that during our survey in the early 70s. The good thing is we found out the table actually had a quarry socket, and you could see it once the two cairns were removed. So there's an astronomical center to the site, and that's when all that astronomy took off in 65, 67. We got the first picture of the sun setting on the winter solstice. You showed a recent picture of that. And, you know, and today we have 57 alignments, and that's summer solstice. You can see that's the winter solstice. You can see the kind of cool-looking shaped stones. You know, they're part of the bedrock, and somebody took about stood them up like that. I don't have the sun setting over there. You can see it's winter, but that is the summer solstice, June 20th or 21st alignment. Yeah, I took that in the winter because I thought it was a pretty picture. But in the summertime, you can see the sun setting on it like the winter.
Well, and this site, once again, archaeologists have been to it. Historians have been to it. Prehistorians have been to it. Nobody seems to have an answer, Dennis. And it's funny because even whenever you go back into the histories of the area, things like that, whenever settlers first came to the area and found it, they asked the Native American population, why'd you build this? And they're like, we didn't build that. That was there when we came here.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I've heard all of those stories over the years. 1907, Edgar Gilbert wrote The History of Salem, said it's a wonderful place among a soft pine and rough boulders where weird tales may be woven. And that was 1907 when that book came out. We have that. It's a very thick book on Salem. And it talks about this area being sold by two Native Americans to people that became part of Havel, Massachusetts. Mm. It was blessed by a very famous Native American chief, Pass Conaway. He was a very tall gentleman. He lived to be 102 or 120. There's some disagreement. But I think the Native American chief was very well respected by both his tribe, other tribes, and also by the Europeans, you know. And he gave his blessing. And this whole region here was sold for 10 pounds and 3 shillings, which is not too much money today. But our property is just a small piece of that. It was all of Haverhill, part of Salem, Hampstead, Atkinson, and maybe Bradford, Mass. It's a big, big area. So we go history back to there. But there are, you know, the legends that some Native Americans thought the place was kind of a taboo place. It wasn't theirs. Somebody else used it, maybe for ceremonial purposes. We've heard those. And if you watch the Holzer files, it ran from 20 to 22. And Hans Holzer, we were on one of the episodes in the second season called Ancient Evil. And they were up here for filming for an entire week. Scott Walters was brought in to do a cameo thing. And it was really cool. They set the whole building up. Our visitor center is a studio. Each late afternoon when we closed to the public, they turned it into like a movie studio. It was so cool. But Daryl Jameson, he's a chief Black Eagle. He's a Wampanoag from around the Plymouth, Massachusetts, that greater area, Cape Cod kind of area. Okay. And he came up in 2015, I think, and he had an episode when he was on the site. He was up here with a couple other people. Might have been Scott Walters at the time, David Brody, a couple other people. But he had an episode on the site. He laid down. He was having difficulty breathing and other stuff. So when they invited him to come back to be on the show 5 years later, he says, well, I'm not going to go up on that hill. You can do my, you know, interview either down at the visitor center or around it, you know. So they decided to set up an outside studio halfway between the building and the watch house, kind of, you know, on what we call the surface. And so if you watch that show, he's on it and he describes, he says, it's not my people that built this. And he goes, it's a beautiful place up there. He goes, but I had a bad reaction to it. And he goes on, and there's a little bit more information about that. So that's kind of his testimony, you know, that it was his group. And they were, you know, around the Massachusetts, greater Massachusetts area. And they did travel a Native American, either on boats, you know, canoes, or dugout canoes, or birch canoes. Or they went on some of the trails, even Route 28 that goes from Cape Cod to the White Mountains goes right by here, you know, a couple miles away. That was a deer trail, I think. It became a Native American trail. And today it's Route 28, you know. And we have a map with actually other Native American trails on both sides of the hill here. But in any event, Paula Underwood, she was from California. She was Iroquois. She didn't grow up, and that's usually near the Great Lakes, New York area, you know, that kind of that tribe. And she wrote Walking People probably 30 years ago. And she visited us twice. She held a couple prayer circles at our site. And she got 10,000 years of history taught to her by her father, I believe. And he had her tell the story back two different ways so he would have an accurate family history, the old tradition. And the Walking People talk about the stone structures that are built generally on hills, not always, but these were strange people that built these structures. And these structures, by the way, do go all over New England and New York. The Hudson Valley's loaded with them. And her group would have been more out that way. She had no idea what this oral tradition meant by stone structures and stone whatever, you know. Well, she didn't know until she heard about our site at some point. I think she was at a lecture and somebody goes, you do know in the Northeast, there are stone chambers that are mysterious. Who built them? What they were used? So then she became familiar with one of our friends who actually wrote a 1996 book about us by Joanne Lambert. She wrote, they became familiar. He got her up here twice. And her story was, it was a strange group of people, but not their people that built these.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Well, you know, I don't know how you take it, but.
Well, I mean, traditionally, whenever you look at the Native Americans that lived and occupied the area and transient hunted the area, things like that, stone was not a part of their construction necessarily. They built wooden longhouses. Right. Yeah. They built wickiups. They built, you know, wigwams, palisades, things like that. But when you're talking about, this is what we're looking at right now on screen, folks, is a very large and long. I personally have been to this exact spot on the property, and you're looking at a wall that is a wall structure that is not knocked over. Whenever you look at this, it looks like maybe it was knocked over. No, this is piled up in that ridged way that you see where it starts wide, goes up skinny. And it follows that path. And as you can see, keeps going. Like, this is at least a couple hundred yards long, just this one segment. Whenever you look at it, and like you were saying in the pre-show, there are modern digs that you guys are doing that showed that this goes down to the bedrock. It's not like it's just on the surface. So, right. And once again, the fact that this was not the style of construction that the local natives took part in. This was not the kind of construction. Here's one of the buildings on property, folks, on top of that hill that he's talking about. And when you start looking at these are not typical wooden structures or something that would, I guess, support wood in that kind of way. Is there evidence of any kind of wood structure being involved with this stuff?
That's a great question, Chris. You know, we've talked about that for years. I began guiding there in 70, you know, and even before that, hanging around there as a kid, that some of those questions, you know, was it like some sort of super wooden, wood superstructure? In other words, above the walls,
sitting
on the
roof
walls
for anything like that.
It's possible. It is possible, Chris. Although, you know, that evidence is rotted away so long ago, that's gone, you know, if there was any wooden structures. And maybe you could see something like in the bedrock, there's a couple places, probably not in the photographs you have, but a couple cutouts in the bedrock. And we often wondered if like a wooden post could have sat. Actually, the bedrock's there, and they cut a hole kind of squarish, if you will. And you can almost imagine a post standing there, you know, but it's circumstantial. We can't really prove it, but it has been discussed. So can you imagine going back maybe 4,000 years ago, and maybe all the stonework was built, and then they used some logs for some part of the construction on top, you know, and that's all disappeared. I mean, it's dirt, it's blown away, you know, washed away or whatever. It's not there today. And the other structures in the Northeast, they number about 800, and that question's been raised with these structures. Yeah. Some of the structures are definitely the big stone walls, kind of shoebox shape, some of them. Great big slabs on the roofs, you know, wooden roofs, but big stone roofs. And that's the watch house, right? Yeah.
No, exactly. When most of the structures on this property would already have a roof on them.
They do, yeah.
You know?
And big stones. Yeah. They're part of the bedrock, yeah.
So
I think the biggest one, Chris, is 14 tons. One of the roof slabs that still exists today is on top of the only two-story building that's in existence and maybe ever were, or perhaps there were others that were two stories tall, but due to the quarry activity in the 1850s, roughly that area, some of the stones were being hauled out of our site by quarrymen, and they were used for local construction projects, so the site was being partially recycled. So it's possible, but this structure called the double solar, Mr. Goodwin called it that. It faces true east, right where the sun rises.
Hmm.
And it has the first story consists of that 14-ton slab roof, and that stone came from about 15 feet away. You can actually see its socket where it came from. And on that is not only the roof, but it's also the floor of the upper story, which has great big slab structure too. So it's a two-story building right near the sacrificial table area, actually.
Yeah.
That slab that was made a little bit easier to extract because one edge of it, the south edge of that slab, which is still the south end edge of it, because they just moved it maybe 15, whatever it was, into the structure, was a joint in the bedrock. It's actually what I think is an earthquake fault line. It goes right across the entire hill, east to west, and it goes to the glacial cliff shelter 1,000 feet away, where we found some pottery dating back about 2,500 years, Middle Woodland period pottery. It was a shelter for Native Americans on that side of the hill overlooking the Spigot River, which is a tributary of the biggest rivers, one of the biggest rivers in New England, not the biggest, but one of the bigger, the Merrimack River that comes out from the White Mountains. Yeah. So that fault line created a beautiful straight edge, and they were able, it's already been cracked by nature, and these folks were able to get under it, wedge it, and the bedrock comes up in layers. It's foliated, so they were able to raise it. And that one edge, they didn't have to touch it. It was just beautifully done by nature because of that. The whole hilltop shifted. One part, I think the south part of the hill, the rock, it's all bedrock. The whole thing moved west, or the other side moved east, or they both moved opposite direction. And one's just a little higher than the other. So it looks like the whole hill cracked in half. It's part of the Clinton Newbury fault, which is actually in Massachusetts. They suggest it's a tributary of the Clinton Newbury fault line, which is kind of famous in geology in the Northeast. we should find out a little bit more about that and see how accurate that is. But hey, the whole hill is split right in half, and I found the crack in the cliff area about 3 years ago. I was out there. I've been out there since a kid, and I finally was looking. I said, "Did that? Where's that crack?" And I was walking, and sure enough, near the shelter where we found the pottery back in 1958-59, and we have it on display in the museum, there's the whole doggone thing split. It's very treacherous walking there, so you have to be careful. When you're looking, you don't fall, because you could fall over the edge, like a little Mesa Verde, which we've been to, and tumble down the bottom, which is actually an area that needs to be excavated, because ancient people, like even at Mesa Verde, we've been there a few times, and other shelters out there, Montezuma's Castle, they would throw their garbage over the front, I think, you know, where they were living, and over the bank. And so things could be at the bottom of that cliff area. We dug inside of the under the shelter, but I think they need to go down at the bottom at some point. Maybe we'll do that on an excavation in the future. But there's that earthquake fault line going right through there, and I don't know how far it goes west, but they took that 14-ton stone out of there, and they had a beautiful edge on it. The other edges, apparently, they shaped a little bit using percussion flaking, stone against stone, you know, like dressing the stone. And so, it is kind of like the Flintstones, you know, big stone roofs, not wooden roofs. And there's a, right on the top right is a top. If you look at the very top right of that picture, that is the top of that structure. That's the upper story of that structure there, called the double solar.
Well, like you're saying, percussion flaking, whenever you look at it, even the sacrificial table, you can see where it has been worked. You can see where there is a groove and called the sacrificial table because it has. I mean, I don't know. I've worked in a kitchen with a nice butcher block. It definitely has a blood groove. This is like it's very similar to what you would have at a butcher station or something like that, where you are draining an animal. You can see this groove, and it's even tilted toward this. Now, granted, with that being said, you do have a museum on property. There have been artifacts found. However, it's not like for the size property this is, and I will bring up that overhead view again just so we can get a good idea of the expanse of this, because it's not necessarily a small property, you know, numerous acres.
Yeah, that's about, I would say that's about 16 or 17 of the 106 acres that are there. Yeah. So all outside that red, it's further, it goes further out. There are walls out there too.
And that's what I was going to say, was that out of the 100 something acres that this property expanses, there are a scant few artifacts, Dennis. You know, and it's not for a lack of digging. It's not for a lack of looking. And that's what makes this place absolutely so fascinating, man, because A, it's an expansive property that obviously people put some time and effort and love into, even if it's the fact that you're coming back season after season to do work. You're talking about something that would expand generations. You know, you're talking about a project, a civil engineering project for an ancient people that would take at least 100 years, something like that, to build, put together, cleave these rocks, move them. Because once again, it's not like they just took them out of the bedrock right there and lifted them up. They brought them from down the road. Yeah. You know,
we have evidence of that, definitely supporting that.
But the fact that you have evidence of that, but you don't have evidence of people living there. You don't have evidence of people occupying the space for an extended amount of time. You have evidence there in the parking area of basically like a wigwam. You know, but even then, not like there's a trash pit where somebody lived there for like 5 years, putting animal bones, things like that, like very scant evidence of actual habitation at this location.
Right. And, you know, Chris, that's a very good point. We think the site's more of a ceremonial site, perhaps burials. It's a place where people came for probably the solstices, weddings. It's all speculation, but it doesn't look like it's a habitat site. And it kind of compares to a lot of the megalithic sites in Europe. There's something like 50,000. We've been to quite a few different countries, the megalithic sites, and they weren't places where people lived. Stonehenge, for instance, is a tomb, temple, and monument, yeah, to our best understanding. But the people didn't live right at Stonehenge. They probably lived close to it. And they're starting to find with LIDAR and also ground penetration radar some of the habitat sites. But they lived in probably hide or wood, or some perishable material that is now gone. But you can find ceramics, you can find stone tools. If they use bronze at some later date, there may be some bronze tools. But it's been frustration to archaeologists in Europe, because when they find these sites like Newgrange, yeah, or even like West Kennet Avenue or Avebury and those sites in England and Ireland, we've been to France, the Karnak, they find all the stonework. They may find some stone tools, but they don't find all the domicile stuff you would discard if you're living right there, the trash, as you mentioned, the middens.
Yeah.
And so what we say is they're fairly clean archaeologically, but they're not dirtied up by people living there and throw all the housewares into a pit. And that's probably because it was a sacred hill, and they wouldn't do that. That's our thought.
Yeah.
But we have found hammer stones, quite a few of them. We have found stone scrapers. We have found stone points, rubbing stones, and various other stone tools.
Okay.
But those were used in the construction, I think, during the construction masonry tools. And
that's what I was going to ask. Are there like piles of chert, where people were working and making arrowheads, the average everyday items that they would use? Or was it more percussion flaking from the working of these stones? I can reach on my back shelf here in just a second and pull out my stone from directly underneath the altar and show people.
Oh, yeah.
because just so you know, folks, not a highly desirable stone to work as a tool in that kind of way. Like pretty porous stone as far as it goes. It's not like it's flint or, chert, something like that, where it's going to make a hard, sharp edge in that kind of way. At least not from my knowledge of percussion flaking and just being a general rocks and minerals hound nerd. It's not something that you would typically work to make a tool out of. You'd be working it for no good reason.
We have found, Chris, though, an area on the south side of the property in the early 90s, and they're doing survey work, marking these points, doing shovel test pits. And we've done about 80 or 90 shovel test pits across the hilltop, and just stopped a couple of years ago when our archaeologist, who joined us in 1989, retired. She was the president of the New Hampshire Archaeological Society. Very well respected and well known throughout New England, and even some of the archaeologists in New York. And her husband was a doctor of geology at Tufts, so they traveled the world too. He's a geologist, she's an archaeologist, and they both sometimes work very good together. And there's a picture of her right there. So she's 95 now, and she just stopped working at Tufts a couple of years ago. I worked with her on quite a few projects up there over the years, particularly in the last 10 years, before she retired, and in the 90s quite a bit too. And she did find an area that looks like a workshop, an area where stone tools were being shaped. And she found rhyolite. And because of her husband's knowledge, too, and her own knowledge, she identified its source about 30 miles south of here, just north of Boston, where this source of this particular rhyolite came from. So it was imported 30 miles, probably by walking. They didn't have highways back in those. And then what the problem was, she thinks it was a workshop, and it was probably about 500 or 600 feet south of the main site. So it was outside one of the perimeter walls, which we think is kind of a sacred area. It was off the side of the hill, down the hill to the south. She said, this area here looks really interesting for habitat. It has proper drainage. It's level enough to build a structure. And there was some, and it's not too far from the Spigot River, a water source. However, they never really got back to exploring that like she wanted to over these 30 years, because she was doing some other projects there. But she really wanted to find a habitat site up there. So in her later years, she was actually scouting out these places, doing several test pits. And we found some really, including an underground stone assemblage or whatever. It looks like a turtle, and it was near a glacial erratic, a big glacial boulder. And she chose that spot, and what we found, and we put plastic over, we covered it, And again, unfortunately, she can't do the work anymore, and she moved to Florida. She's been back once in the last 4 years since she moved down there. But it looks like a turtle effigy, and it had two pulse moles. Pulse moles were a post was once set up in this effigy. For some reason, two poles were set up, and what it left when they rotted was these stains right where the poles used to stand in the stone effigy. It kind of looks like a turtle at this stage, but it was not. It needs more work. We need to get back in there at some point, take the dirt off, take the plastic off, you know, take pictures of it again and get in, explore it more, because it's strange. It's because I've been in this since the, I guess around 1980, we got involved with archaeology or late 70s. Because she's been all over New Hampshire working on paleo, archaic, woodland period, contact period, all of this. And she goes, I hadn't seen anything like this. That was something that always grabbed her up there. And it's several inches below the surface level. We brought it back to that. It's protected now. And I was just like, this thing's pretty amazing. And what is this thing? And why is this here? And why are there two pulse moles? And it's, she brought in a Tufts University gentleman, a doctor of geology, to see if he could see that was anything geological. Could this be natural? And he looked at it and goes, no, this is all man-made.
Yeah.
It turns out that he was a student of her husband's at Tufts University. So he had her husband for a professor, and now he's a doctor. Her husband, unfortunately, died almost 30 years ago on Route 93 in New Hampshire's one of his biggest turnpikes. And she actually did all the impact study on that for the state of New Hampshire in the 90s. And in 2020, they finally finished the project to widen the lanes to four lanes each direction, all the way up to Manchester, New Hampshire. But she's the one that did the impact study on that. And unfortunately, she was doing that in the 90s, that long ago. And they finally finished it, you know, almost 6 years ago. Her husband was traveling down there, just retired from Tufts. And again, they traveled all over the world. And I would talk to him on the phone. You know, he was great, you know, very knowledgeable, a lot about this area. And that's very important, the geology.
Yeah.
And somebody hit him in a car that was apparently drinking. And, you know, and we found out about 2 weeks later. My mom goes, you know, Dr. James Hume? I said, yeah, he's been in the paper. And we didn't hear anything, no social media. And she goes, I said, that's Pat Hume's husband. And she goes, he got killed. On this date, I'm like, are you? Because we hadn't seen, we would see Pat, we'd work with her, then we might, she's on a project with the Flower Club or the New Hampshire Archaeological Society. She'd come back a month or two later and start working on a project. So we missed her for a few weeks. And in that time period, her husband passed. Wow. So it's really sad, but it definitely looks like a turtle. It has a, it's all built out of small stones. And on either side of it has those pulse moles. And it's near a great big glacial erratic or boulder. That's kind of cool. I'd love to get back to that thing. It's just, what the heck is that thing?
When you get into the geology, once again, here is my sample, and this was one of the two that you allowed me to take. Please, folks, do not just go and take stones from places, all right? Even though I've had a couple people smuggle me things from, no doubt, I got a cool piece of rock from Rapa Nui. But I asked permission.
You had permission.
Specifically so that we could show this on air whenever we have you on. And as you can see, like, this is a typical example of granite state rock. Very, very granite in its way. Tons of mica fleck in there, stuff like that. But the point is, and this is about the size of a spearhead. Something like that. But if you listen to it, pretty dull sounding, you know, as opposed to an actual spearhead, which as you can see, not porous, very, very smooth in its way and totally different sound. The density is totally different. Yeah. So this would not make a good workable rock. As far as turning it into a tool or something sharp, something that's a weapon to get you food or scrape fat off of something. However, it would make a great structural material. It'd make a great material if you ground it down and mixed it with a little bit of lime. You could probably have some good mortar, something like that. But as far as structural material for a wall, like what we're talking about, structural material for these cairns that we're talking about, perfectly suitable for that and very easily workable and napped when it comes to using a harder diorite or something like that from the area, you know.
Well, that's very true. Yeah, we do have quartz crystals that were found up there in 1963 in the upper well. We also have quartz just quartz, you know, and one of them is an illumination inside the watch house. It's quartzite. As you mentioned, the granite, because that's kind of kind of a more igneous, I think, a little more. But the schist we have there is made by, it's a metamorphic stone. And speaking of what you just held in your hand, Mary Kramer, back in 1982, one of our staff was taking a break from her guiding deep duties up there. And that during that time, I was up in Vermont for my first airline, so I wasn't there. I was gone for almost 3 years. And during that time, she was a guide, and she worked the building, and she worked on the site. And she was taking a little break for lunch and sat out in the woods on the north side of the property on a stone, a big slab, like, and she sat there having a lunch, and she's just sitting there, and she starts to realize, I guess, the stone looks pretty cool, and she's sitting on it, and she reaches down, and she reaches underneath it, and she pulls out a piece, something like what you had in your hand, and she realizes it was this. It's nothing you would not want to make stone tools out of. However, this was actually knocked off the edge that she was sitting on, and as she looked at the edge of the stone, this is a big slab, it's kind of propped up in the air, she goes, huh, I can see dimpling along the edge. I think somebody was striking this like an arrowhead edge, you know, that serrated edge.
Yeah.
And she looked underneath it, and the whole thing was elevated. And it was probably a slab 8 feet by 5 feet. You couldn't see all of it because there was pine needles and some debris on top of it, but what she could make out of it, and it looks like it had been raised up in the air and supported by another rock underneath. She brought that to the attention of Dr. David Stewart Smith in 1982, and he had already informed our staff, which is great, including her, to look for our stones that could be slabs that are still out in the woods that might be had intentions of being part of the main site construction, but never brought to the site.
Yeah.
And so showed Dave, he was pretty excited. He looked at it very cautiously and said, yep, this stone was raised off the bedrock. It looks like it's been propped up by a stone that they could see underneath of it. The big thing was the edge of it looked like the edge of an arrowhead. It was all serrated. He goes, this has been worked with a stone hammer by somebody. And that piece of schist he had was really big. Somebody had clobbered that edge, knocked that off, dressing and shaping the stone. So the next year, David Stewart Smith had Dr. Gary Hume, not Dr. James Hume, same last name. They all know each other. He's a doctor of archaeology. He was a 1976 part-time first state archaeologist of New Hampshire. By 1980, he was full-time. So he went from a part-time job to a full-time job, which is wonderful. And he had already been working on a couple projects at our property, which is wonderful because, again, he's a mainstream outsider. And they're usually Native American as well as colonial and post-colonial archaeology. But to have stone ruins is something that wasn't in their vocabulary.
Yeah.
So he came in. And he was got interested, and Pat Hume became friends with Dr. Gary Hume, because after her husband died, some people thought they were married because they lived in the next door in towns. I was weird, you know. But anyway, he was a lithic specialist. He knew about tool making out of stone, you know, stone tools, utensils, weapons. And he got involved with that in 83, and they did an excavation. So he kind of oversaw David Stewart Smith, who had a doctorate in historical anthropology. He was a certified archaeologist. He eventually got a doctorate in theology, too. Dave's a really interesting guy. But they dug around, and they found hundreds of little stone flakes or spallings that had been knocked off in the dressing process right underneath the stone. So Mary Kramer, bless her heart, she actually saw that, recognized it, because what Dave kind of instructed them. And she brought it to his attention. 1 year later, they're digging it. After that, we started finding a few more. Today, there are 34 of these quarried stones from a few feet across up to, I think the biggest one's about 13 feet in length, roughly, by probably about 5 feet. And it's 163 pounds per cubic foot, the weight of granite. So you could do the weight calculation.
Wow.
They're all over the hill. And a couple of them are over 1,000 feet down the hill from the main site. And our speculation is that they intended those stones that are way out there to be brought up the hill and be used in the construction where the main site is, where all these big stone structures are. And more recently, we found a few more. And we started thinking, you know what? These guys were still building this place, and they abandoned it. And then that raised all sorts of, you know, interesting questions and imagination, too. You know, was it warfare? Was it disease? Was it some other reason that they abandoned the site? Because they were in the process of building it. It's like, you know, you might have like a building going up, and then they run out of funds, and the building's half done. It's a mess. And then it starts, you know, That kind of thing is like, you guys intended to build that, right? And build the whole thing, and yet only part of it's there. So there are 34 of these stones today out all over the hilltop. We've been GPSing them, and I'm sure we're going to find a few more of these just because they hide in plain sight, even the big ones, because over the years, the soil's covering them, trees grow on top of them, brush covers them, and it's like, how did we never see that before? If we do a clearing, like we did a forest management thing, we found a few more. Wow, you know, there they are, you know.
Even the windows that are in these walls. But once again, the fact that they, and let me get back to the picture of the serpentine wall, because it's not the only one there. This is not any way to mark a property line. This is not how a traditional New England stacked wall looks. I mean, unless you're on a hell of a lot of cider, you know what I mean?
Maybe a hot cider.
You'd have to have a few buckets of hard cider in you for your property wall to end up looking like that, Dennis. Like you just said before the recording, though, the fact that new digs, new things that you guys have found have shown the fact that these are not just surface walls. It's not like they just go and you know, for the type of forest it is, things like that. I forget what the calculation was, but it's basically like an inch every 150 years. Something like that, correct?
Soil accumulation, about 1.5 per in New England, It varies, though, you know.
But when you're talking dirt just being made from leaf litter and blowing dust and things like that, it's about 100-something years. These walls that are there with the windows and the serpentine walls go well beyond 125 years. They go well beyond a few hundred years. They go well beyond the point of settlers being there. They go down to the bedrock. And when you start looking, especially at the astronomic alignments, because it'd be tough, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, you say, oh, look at all the trees. None of these trees are extremely old. None of these trees are anywhere near, like, we have 100-year-old oaks all around us here in Texas. I see 100-year-old trees. Ain't none of these trees here 100 years old on this property that are blocking this stuff. So if this stuff goes down to the bedrock, like you're saying, then it goes back thousands of years. It goes to a point where this was just open rock land, just open rock face, almost no dirt on it whatsoever, no purchase for any of these trees to have root even.
Well, that's what Pat, you know, starting in 89, she's working on the North Stone project, and they went down a couple feet next to it, and they found a fire pit that dated 1300, about 700 years old. I think it was 12. What the devil was the date on that? 750 AD. And it was a fire pit built right next to it was a stone similar to that, but it's the North Stone monolith. And it was an incredible find because they were digging next to it because the stone was starting to fall to the south. These stones eventually someday probably will all fall over if you give enough time, perhaps, due to earthquakes and, you know, various even frost, although they are sitting in bedrock, frost action maybe from the side a little bit, or people pushing over trees. You know, trees fall on these things too, right? Big trees. But anyway, I was falling to the south very slowly after, you know, it'd been there probably a few thousand years. So as they excavated that in 89, 90, 91, they finished the project, we found that fire pit. Again, it dated 1,200, almost 1,300 years old, and it was next to the stone. So the monolith is a backstop for the fire, and the soil above it was undisturbed. It was in layers of stratigraphy, and as they got through it, the charcoal fire pit was intact, and they went down below that, and they sent the charcoal in. It came back 1,300 years old. They went down several inches, I guess over a foot, and they got near the bottom of the stone, and eventually they found that the bottom of the stone was sitting in a crevice in the bedrock. So whoever stood that stone up took advantage of a little dip in the bedrock, and then they put packing stones around it and the wall that's there. And then years later, somebody built a fire. You can say, well, the Patty family that were there, maybe they stood it up. You know, that's been the old argument. A bunch of farmers, nothing better to do. Crazy too, or eccentric. But if they had put that stone there, number one, they would have shaped it using stone tools. There's no metal tool markings on all these stones that are roof slabs, wall slabs, monoliths. On top that, the fire pit's there, and the fire pit's against the stone. So if they had dug down to put the stone slab in there, say, 200 years ago, they would have disturbed the strata, they would have destroyed the fire pit, the charcoal, and they would have put the stone there, and then they would have packed stuff against it, and that would have just turned all the stuff over. And that's not the way it was. It had to be that the fire pit came after stone was stood up. It was undisturbed. And so that stone's been standing there at least 1,300 years. And because of the other datings on the site and the astronomical data, we think it goes back about 4,000 years. It'd be nice to find more evidence to support that date. But the hilltop is probably 75% bare. You were kind of getting into that because Pat Hume, like I mentioned, did about 80 shovel test pits. And that's one of the things we were looking at is not only archaeological data, but geological data. And her husband was wonderful up to the time he died because she was reporting back starting in 1991. She began doing shovel test pits after that three-year project on the North Stone we were just discussing with the fire pit. So right after that, and that was all wrapped up, all backfilled, and everything was put back, and the reports were written, she started on an STP project across the entire hill, mapping all around the hilltop. And by the late 90s, she says, you know, I think 75% of the hilltop was bare bedrock. There was vegetation, trees, but when these people were moving these big slabs of stone, they didn't have to face a forest in their way.
Yeah, yeah.
Or soft soil. To move these stones over soft soil is not a good thing either, with log rollers or something. And they could actually choose places to quarry the stone. And if I sent you up there with, you know, with your wife or friend today, hey, Chris, I need some big slab up there. You'd be like, what are you, crazy? The whole place is covered with trees, dirt, roots, vegetation. Where am I supposed to find the ideal places to quarry? Because they had to work fissures or cracks in the bedrock, and that's what they were doing. And with exposed bedrock, we could walk around and see it. But with dirt all over the hilltop today, it's really, you need Superman vision, or you need ground penetration radar or something. They dig here. You can find a rock. You're going to be able to raise the slab off of, you know, but it all makes sense without a forest and all the dirt. It does make a lot of sense for what we see up there, you know.
Well, and that's just it. You know, it's the fact of, like we were saying a second ago, it is all young forest. You know, none of it is old growth forest where it's like this is 300 years old or something like that. And when you begin to look at just the LIDAR mapping of these walls once again,
that's LIDAR. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
This is not a plot of acreage in that kind of way. You know, like this is there is no rhyme or reason to how this is cut. If you were to be dividing property line. Like that. Even if you were dividing something amongst kids that you didn't like, Dennis.
Right. It doesn't make sense.
This tiny little slice right here that's still kind of open to John's land, that's for Margaret. Because, you know, nobody really likes Margaret.
We'll give her that little piece there. But you're right. If you look at farmers' walls, it makes sense the way they were laid out. You know, and they were doing field clearings, getting those rocks out of there so they wouldn't hit them with their plow.
And they also aren't built down to the bedrock on cobble.
They sit on a lot of earth, and that causes a problem with frost heaving, you know? So this is different. This is sitting on, bedrock and then cobbles and then the big stones on top. We're going to do more checking on the walls. But that's an interesting design or construction technique. That farmers, I mean, that's a big thing. And you brought that up. It's like, that's a big thing, you know, compared to just taking rocks, sticking them in a wall on the ground. And they're like Robert Frost, every spring, these rocks pop out of the ground and they would go over and they mend the wall. He had poems about that whole thing. You know, Robert Frost, my grandfather had him for a teacher up at Pekin, but he was nearby here. But and I have that in my new book, a little quote from him. And that's what the farmers' walls were, you know.
Yeah.
This is different, a whole different. We have slabs of stone in our walls. The farmers use generally rounded. You'll find exceptions, but most of farmers' walls were kind of rounded glacial rocks that we call glacial erratics, small and big. Our stone walls have some of those boulders, small and big, but they have a lot of slab work, like right there. Slabs of stone that were part of the bedrock. and they were taking off the bedrock specifically to build these walls. What farmer would go out and manufacture stones off the bedrock? That's work in itself, you know?
Yeah, that's laborious.
They're trying to get rid of these dang things. Look at those slabs right there, you know?
Massive, massive slabs. Mm-hmm. And once again, slabs that go into the tons at this place.
Into the tons, yeah.
And when you start talking about the chambers that are there, even the interconnectivity of some of the chambers, the chamber just underneath, the oracle chamber, as it's called, just oracle, underneath the table. If you look, folks, there's this tiny little wall back here. Like, this is a room that you can walk into. And there's a tiny little hole right here underneath that you can like project your voice from inside of there to under the table. Yeah. It's wild construction. And it reminds me of like Minos and stuff like that, like where the ancient Greeks would have like statues of their gods with holes like that.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that for ceremonial use, where it would sound like the bull was talking. You know,
we've been to Delphi on our anniversary. I mean, our wedding honeymoon. We went to Greece for a couple of weeks in Rhodes, but we saw Delphi, a lot of other places around Greece. But they had the oracles, the females, and interesting enough, they had an earthquake fault line there too that may have emitted gases that affected the oracles psychologically. But the fault line seems to be a characteristic, I guess would be the word, of a lot of these ancient sites. And I talked to Maria Wheatley, about some of the stone circles that go from Wales into England, and because Scotland has a massive number, like 700 or 800, just like Wales does.
Yep.
And she goes, they sit on fault lines or within 1.5 miles of fault lines. All these in Wales, there's about 700 of them. I got to check on, we've been to Scotland, I haven't checked on that too, but Machu Picchu is built on a fault line too. Our site is built on the fault line, or a joint, whatever you want to call it. The whole hill has been cracked in half, and Delphi has that. It does not emit gas today that I know of. I've done some reading about that. I think it's fascinating. We've been to it. Yeah. It wasn't when we were there, you know. I maybe take a sniff and see what happens if I was there, just to tell. Although I was flying too, I have to be careful when you're a pilot. You can't do certain things. Things, you know, but it would have been interesting. But maybe in ancient times,
inhalants being one of them.
Yeah, it's weird, huh? And who knows at our site what they were doing? You know, maybe there were some gases too, or mushrooms. I don't know.
You know, it's a distinct possibility, and I have even floated the fact of it being once again an astronomic site. If you begin to look at the direction that many of the openings face, they face away from the setting sun, you know, so like the first place that you would start seeing constellation, stuff like that. So,
it would
make a prime location to just crawl in and peep sight, you know, even the idea of the peep sights in the walls that are everywhere.
And that's something we're looking at. That's a big question. Are those windows? Maria kind of tends to think, I believe, she has them in Dartmoor, England, and they're called soul holes in the walls like ours. She's done dowsing on them, and they seem to have energy. She describes a different type of energy. But initially, she said it's actually where the soul can flow through. And then she got into much more detail. And we have 36 of those on our site. Some have Venetian blind shutters, some have stone slab. So they could open and close them, you know? In some cases, are the cobbles. There's 7 with cobbles, these stone cobbles that are placed. They're a problem because they disguise the hole in a wall. You don't see the hole. You see a wall. And if you look close, you go, oh, my God, there's a sill. There's a lintel, you know, a lintel on top, sill, and the cobbles. And I've been going by that wall for decades, and I never realized that could be another window because those cobbles block the view through it. And we have 7 like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and once again, even where those rounded cobbles meet inside the wall, like that's a perfect peep site. That's the rear end of a rifle scope or the rifle site, you know?
A little gun sight thing.
So it's fascinating. And once again, the fact that there are next to no artifacts at this location, unlike other places that we've mentioned, Stonehenge, things like that, there are no adjunct burial grounds. There are no adjunct ritualistic centers in that kind of way. So it's just, it's mysterious. It's strange. It is quite literally curious. And that is why I love it so much, Dennis, because it's stuck square off of Route 1. Yeah. Like it's right there. It is square in the middle of New Hampshire. It's absolutely awesome. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go, because you guys have events year round. You have amazing Equinox events that all kinds of people, Brad Olson, Scott Walter, all kinds of people have come and spoken at. My good friend David Wilcock has been there, or not David Wilcock. Let everybody know where they can go to find out more, where they can go to find out how to have events there, how to come and be a part of everything.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Yeah, so our website is stonehengeusa.com. And when you go in there, there are links. There's also a event calendar, like you mentioned. Equinox will be actually August 1st has already happened. That is a cross quarter day. But the fall equinox is coming up. And that day is really interesting. On the sunrise, there is the watch house, which has an illumination inside of it. And quartzite stone gets illuminated over a 1 hour period. That's all new to us since 2020. It's pretty amazing. But the calendar will have the drumming circles. We have snowshoeing in the wintertime. We get the winter solstice, of course, coming up in about 5 months from now. There's some archaeology going on too, and special tours of the site with our manager, James. He does these Saturday tours. They're kind of a value added, but we have VIP tours too. And those are by reservation, usually a couple people. And it's like a 3 hour tour. But StonehengeUSA.com, if they go to the free mobile app download, you can for free do a complete virtual tour of the entire site. It will show you a picture of the chamber. It will talk to you, and it has text. And if you use it on the tour here, you can use it right on the tour. And as you're walking, it's so cool, too. Again, it's the same thing. You'll see the structure right in front of you. You'll see the picture of it to make sure you're looking at the right thing. It will talk to you, and it has text. Also, 11-minute videos on that, and a phone number, email address is on that. And the only days we close are Thanksgiving and Christmas. We're open all year round, as long as we don't have some major northeastern storm. And when we have about 6 inches of snow, we open up the entire hilltop for snowshoeing. And some of these trails go by other quarried slabs. They go by some of the other windows, and they go by some of the other serpentine walls that you don't see on the regular tour, which covers about 16 acres of the 106. So it covers, I guess, over 90 more acres of land, including the glacial cliff shelter. You actually can walk down below it and come right up. It's so beautiful out there to walk below it and look up at it. It looks like a little mini Mesa Verde, you know, which you've been to. It's not a cliff dwelling kind of place, you know. So that's our website. They can call us too. Our number's on the website, you know, if they have any questions. And we do weddings up there. Sometimes companies have outings up there, birthday parties up there. And we have a whole new area called the Serenity Garden. And it's really a beautiful area for events of that kind. You know, that's all new since you've been there. So
awesome.
When you come back, we'll show you that.
Well, yep. Always great catching up. Always great to hear about the new stuff. Every time I talk with you, this is why I love having people back on the show a couple times a year, man, because if you have an active site like yours, there is always something new being discovered. There's always some kind of news. So thank you so much for coming on, as always, sharing the updates. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience for this segment, Dennis.
Thank you so much, Chris, and your audience. And we'll have to have you come up there and do a live podcast if we can. Now, that'd be wonderful. I think you did that a couple of years ago.
We will make that happen, guaranteed, my friend.
Have a nice day, Chris. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick. While we are online, everybody, checking out everything from America's Stonehenge at StonehengeUSA.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find the embedded video channels of our guests, all their YouTube, so you can easily like and follow and subscribe to their content as well. That's also where you can get your link to the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator in the world of UFOs, UAPs, cryptozoology, paranormal, this is your back pocket field log to write down all of your data in a scientific way so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day you need to do so. Thank you, as always, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.